When I was a child, the lucky bag would be something. A local corner sweet shop would sell a little flimsy plastic bag, and he put in bits of leftovers from various sweet jars that he was getting rid of, and sometimes have just the dust from the ends of a jar of sweets. I don't mean like dust as in sawdust. These sweet shops I'd go to as a child, they'd have a big jars in the window. A jar would be full of a particular type of penny sweet. That penny sweet would have crumbs coming off it. A very sweet tasty dust. And a shopkeeper, where I came from occasionally, he'd say, oh, would you like a bag of dust from this sweet jar that I've just finished? He'd give it to me for free, which was very nice. My local sweet shop for a time. I was friends with the shopkeeper. He was very nice. He used to do things like that for me. He'd say, here's a bag of leftovers from the dust from one of my sweet jars. Now, that didn't make up for the fact that my father went into that sweet shop one day for his Sunday morning newspaper and promptly collapsed outside the shop door and within half an hour was dead. But that wasn't the shopkeeper's fault. He was a very nice man. He went on, I understand, to have heart issues himself. That shop is a residential premises now. I think it was turned into an apartment. Well, no, that was a very nice local sweet shop. Very old-fashioned sweet shop. I don't think the kids have that anymore. What do the children do nowadays? If you give them their 10 pence of pocket money and they go out, I'm going to spend this on sweets, where do they go? I can't imagine. Do they even have pick and mixes in supermarkets? I don't think so. Where do they go? Because there's no sweet shops. Did they go to the convenience store and queue up behind the various people doing Lotto tickets and buying bottles of wine and convenience microwave foods and say, hello, can I have a penny from that jar and a penny from that jar? I don't think so. I don't see sweet jars in windows anymore. Did they buy prepackaged sweets? Maybe they do. Maybe they buy a packet of pre-mixed sweets. It's like buying one of those vodka mixers. Nowadays, if you want to get vodka or something, but you don't want to drink straight vodka, you get a selection pack of 8 cans of vodka mixed with various things, and they're in little cans. I suppose it's like that for the children. So maybe they don't eat sweets at all anymore. Did the children eat sweets at all anymore? I have to admit, I'm completely out of touch with that world. Do the children eat sweets anymore? Surely they must. Well, what do they eat? Surely they don't just go around picking raspberries off people's hedges. Surely they don't just do that. We used to do a bit of that. We used to eat blackberries and things off hedges. Or we'd collect them and bring them home to our parents. And our parents would say, what in the name of Christ am I supposed to do with this? And you'd be fully expecting them to produce jam or something from it. No, that's not how it works. No, you eat them and then you make yourself sick. That's what you do. You eat them. Do the children eat things off hedgerows and make themselves sick anymore? They probably don't. They probably don't. Or they probably do it in some virtual world on some app. Or they don't live near each other, but they do go out still and they pick these things off a hedge. But while they're doing it, they're connected to some app. The video gamers do this thing now where they stream themselves playing a game so other people can watch them playing the game like it's a podcast or something. That's fascinating to me. If I wanted to play a game on this, I wouldn't. Because for one thing, I don't play video games. Why would you play video games? They're shit. Video games are shit. Every last one of them is shit. Every last one of them, it rots your mind. It turns your mind into complete mulch and shit and tripe and dirt and muck and filth. Now, I know I did say later in the program that it's good for you to exercise the mind by adjusting your Venetian blind every morning. Stuff like that helps exercise your mind. So I suppose you can probably get a similar effect from some well-designed video games. Those word games, I suppose. There's something to be said for that. Well, most of the video games are just you going around with a gun, pointing the gun at some monster and going, I hereby shoot you in the head, monster. You're not really shooting the monster in the head. You do realise that, of course. But you're pressing a button, and by pressing the button, that symbolically is you shooting the monster in the head, and that's marked down on the score tab as you having shot that monster in the head, and you get whatever credit is available to you for doing that. which apparently is quite substantial in the gaming world. Shooting a monster in the head, it's like doing 2 hours work in the real world. The few games I've played, every little thing you do, you get thousands and thousands of points on the scoreboard. Take a step forward and you see your score tally going up by thousands. Couple of levels in, your score will be up to 3,965,000. Then you'd see, you know, there's another 59 levels of this. I'm nowhere near having achieved anything. You used to hear about these countries in the 80s and 90s where their currency was devalued so much they'd have to bring a huge bag of coins in with you to buy a banana in the local supermarket. It's like that. The points have been devalued in these games, so they're meaningless, absolutely meaningless. And that's going to continue as the, what's that fella? There's that fella's law. There's this fella, something to do with computers, that he says, as the processing capacity of the computer chip expands, it's going to double every 5 years or something like that. Well, it's like that with computer game points. Every new game that gets invented, people are expecting you to get 3 million points for every monster they shoot, and it's just going to get higher and higher and higher. They're going to be up into the billions. They're not going to be able to fit your score on the screen. They're going to start having to do it like the mathematicians do it. Instead of putting 8,955 trillion, your score will be something like 80 to the power of 65. And you're going to have to just trust the game that it's keeping score correctly, because of course these kids aren't going to know how to do 82 to the power of 50. They won't know what that means. They're just going to assume that one of those numbers goes up a couple of digits every time you achieve anything. A game could fake that. It could just make the digits go up a bit and it would be meaningless. And that's what you want your children doing. Fake mathematics. At least, at the very least, if you want to save your children from this. If you can't help them with their homework or supervised or schoolwork or help them with anything like that, the very least you could do is keep an eye on how the scoring is done on their computer games and see if it starts doing this 85 to the power of 62. Just check the maths. See, is that being calculated properly or is it just made up? The very least, if enough parents did that, at least keep that in check so it's not a complete joke. That's the very least you could do. Do it while your child is in the toilet vomiting up the blackberries that they picked earlier. I know what you're thinking there. You're thinking, wait a minute, did he just tell a big long thing about his childhood sweet shop and then put a thing in the middle about how his father dropped dead after going into a sweet shop? Well, yes, in a way, and that's all true, but my father wasn't visiting that shop in his capacity as a sweet shop. He was visiting it in his capacity as a local corner food store and newsagent. It wasn't a fully fledged newsagent, but it sold all the main newspapers. We used to have newsagents' shops in those days that would sell a large selection of newspapers and magazines and comics. Often there'd be a newsagent and tobacconist. But that local shop was more of a very local corner food store of the type that you Americans have that cutesy word for, little corner grocery store that sells everything and usually has a cat that lives there. It's like one of them. Well, my father wasn't visiting there to get sweets. These shops, they rarely sell just sweets. They have more than one face, these shops. When a child comes in that has the face of a sweet shop, we go in there as a child and we say sweet shop. An adult goes in there and sees face where I can get a small bottle of milk and half a pan of bread and an emergency supply of brown sauce that I run out of and I don't want to go all the way down to the supermarket. That's the face they show to adults. To my father, it was the place where you could buy a newspaper and have a stroll down to your local corner shop on a Sunday morning after breakfast, get the Sunday newspaper, then walk home. Except that one occasion, he didn't quite make it home. He made it to just outside the shop, and then he collapsed. There was no walking home. This is probably a bit dark, is it? Well, I'm very sorry that part of my childhood was dark. Most of my childhood was sunshine and sunny days and happy days. In fact, much of that morning was sunshine and happy days. Because that morning, about an hour before that happened, I remember sitting at the breakfast, enjoying some toast and marmalade, happily swinging my feet beneath me off the chair and reading probably Whizzer and Chips comic, which I didn't get from that shop. That shop didn't sell comics. I had to go slightly further afield to get my comics. I just got my sweets there. I probably got the comic on the day before on the Saturday, because that was a Sunday. Oh no, that day wasn't all darkness and shit happening. No, the first hour of the day was great. I enjoyed breakfast, had a nice read of my comic. I remember my father noticing that I seemed to be enjoying myself. He going, "Are you happy?" I probably went, "Yeah," or something. And then he went down to the shop. Didn't buy any sweets, as far as I know. He bought a newspaper and then left the shop. Then people noticed, "Wait a minute, that fella isn't leaving the shop properly. He seems to be on the ground. He's probably doing something about that." And whatever they could, they did. The rest of that day, I admit, was a bit dark. It got a bit dark then. So things went downhill from there. Life is a mixture of the good and the bad, the ups and the downs, the black and the whites, the ones and the zeros, the Saddam Husseins and the Mother Teresas. Although a lot of people seem to look on Mother Teresa as a bad thing now. Her existence, they say, that's a bad thing. Jeez, me to wonder. I happened to come across once Mother Teresa's last words. Apparently this is real and official. Her last words on this earth, Mother Teresa, according to the reports, were, "I cannot breathe." And you read that and you think, oh God, that's awful. That sounds awful. Her last words were, "I cannot breathe." Apparently, she used her last breath to say that, so I suppose. So, she got enough breath in to commute. Oh, don't know how that helps. They would have noticed that she wasn't breathing, I presume, anyway. I presume she was in a hospital and they had things all wired up to her. They had a thing that went off every time someone wasn't breathing. They say, "Alarm, alarm, this person isn't breathing. Come over and tell them to breathe." That's getting dark again, isn't it? It's okay. It wasn't my mother. Mother Teresa wasn't my mother. So it was not that dark. It's not like the dark story from my childhood. No. There's a song in which Christy Moore, the much admired Irish folk singer, has a song. One of the lines in this song is, "Mother Teresa was taking the pill." I forget what song, but I think it was a humorous song. It wasn't factual. But he's allowed to do stuff like that. I can say factual stuff about what her last words were. Anyway, the rest of that day, things went downhill quite a bit from there, I'll admit. Life is a mixture of ups and downs, and over there and back there, and forwards and backs, and yin and yang. Is that what they call it? Yin and yang. Good and bad. There's no such thing as good if you don't have bad for contrast. It's about contrast. So in order for you to enjoy being alive, you also have to experience being dead for a while. Or in order to enjoy people being alive, you have to enjoy, well, not enjoy, but experience them not being alive at some point. If you win the lotto on the first day of your life, you probably spend your whole life wondering, oh, I wonder what it would be like to lose the lotto. I hope to experience that one day. You probably start obsessing about it. You become a gambler, you start putting down $500,000 on a poker table somewhere. You put on your best poker face. A poker face is where you're playing cards, and whatever way the game of poker works, it's very important that people not see what you're thinking, because whatever's on your face could give away what cards you have and what cards they're going to put down or what they're going to gamble on. So you have to make your face look completely blank and not have it so that they're thinking, oh, he's doing his blank face, that means he's got a good hand. Or he's doing his blank face, that means he has a great hand. He always does that when he has a great hand. No. The best thing you could do, I suppose, is cover up your face. You never see that. I watch Star Trek The Next Generation. They portray the senior staff sometimes as gathering around at the end of their program and doing a poker night. And they're all doing their poker faces. It never occurs to anyone to just cover their face. Put a balaclava on over it. If it's good enough for the IRA, it's good enough for Worf or Data or Captain Picard or what's her name, the Doctor. Wait a minute, the fella Geordi who was blind and who wore a visor, a magic visor to help him see. Did he play poker? I'm not sure. He probably would have been good with a poker face, would he? When you're doing a poker face, you can't just look like a poker. Because a poker is a big round thing with spikes coming over. That's terrifying. It's going to be children seeing you like that. I know your children aren't normally playing poker. I'd be playing a friendly family game of poker at home with no real money involved. Maybe you're playing Monopoly money poker. Then you'd let your kids be involved. You can't be doing a real genuine poker face when you're doing that because you'll terrify them. Like some monster out of a horror film whose face is all covered in spikes for some reason. I don't know, maybe it's the ghost of someone who died in a nuclear accident. They're completely covered in spikes, so they're like a poker ball that you stoke a fire with. Is that what poker is? I think it is. Isn't it poker? A big metal sphere with spikes coming out of every face of it. Isn't that what a poker face is? And the idea is, it looks exactly the same from every angle. It doesn't give anything away except the fact that it's a poker, which is more than enough, because the fact that it's a poker is terrifying. So do you use it to stoke a fire? I think so. We used to have fire stoking equipment on the fireplace, hanging on a fire utensil holder beside the fire. There was no poker involved. There was a kind of a brass shovel and the brass tongs. There was no poker. So you can light a fire in a house in a fireplace without needing a poker. I think people used to exaggerate the need for a poker at home. You don't need a poker to stoke a fire. You can just knock it around with the tongs. You have a tongs, you can move the coals around a bit. You have a little brass shovel. That's more than enough to stoke a fire. There's no need for a big ball thing with spikes all over it. No, that's weird. If anyone you know who lights fires at home has a poker, ask them to explain exactly what they need that for. That seems a bit unnecessary and superfluous. That's like saying you need a gun because there might be kids coming around to the house trick-or-treating. Oh, that's overkill. That's a weirdo. If you know someone who's got a poker, and their excuses that they light fires in their fireplace in their sitting room and they need a poker to stoke the fire, that's bollocks. That's bollocks. Keep an eye on them, because that's not normal. It's not normal at all. You don't need a poker for that. We lit fires for years and years. We had a sitting room. We had a proper fireplace. We had fire-making equipment. We had coal sometimes, or wood sometimes, or homemade paper baguettes. Never once used a poker, and it was perfectly fine. No need for it. We had a thing as well that you could stoke the fire with. It was just a long thing. It just had a pointy end in it, like a brass stick. That was more than enough. No need for a round thing with spikes in it. That's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Into your head. We've a lot to get on with today. Items that need to be attended to. Issues that need to be addressed. We're positively booming to the seams with topics. We've got topics coming out of... topics coming out of this mouth. This mouth. Now, nothing has emerged so far. I've been in here half an hour. Very little of substance has emerged yet. But we live in hope. As the song goes, there's a song, Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel. And they go... Don't give up, cause something, something, something. Don't give up, cause there's something in the thing. Kate Bush's character in this song is comforting Peter Gabriel's character over the stress of long-term unemployment or being made redundant or something. But you can well imagine the apply to a situation where Peter Gabriel is trying to do a podcast and he's having trouble getting going. And Kate Bush is there going, don't give up, don't give up, don't give up. Of course, that would be a problem then, because that's commercial music. You can't use commercial music on a podcast unless you have some sort of very extremely expensive license because you're a broadcaster or something. You can't use that. So she'd be of little help to Peter Gabriel in that situation if she just started singing a song that's being a major hit. And it's clearly commercial, it's clearly licensed to Sony Universal Music or whoever it is, I don't know, Parlophone or EMI or whoever owns it. Geffen, is it? Probably .Geffen. Geffen is Guns N' Roses. It's unlikely they're from that stable of music. Do you young people remember Guns N' Roses? You probably don't. You probably have your own music because you grew up in a different decade, and that's fine. That's as it should be. You should have your own music. There's no reason you should be listening to the same crap we listened to 3 decades ago. When I was a teenager, I listened to Billy Joel and Queen, and then later on, I discovered Guns N' Roses. Guns N' Roses were just heavy rock band, bordering on heavy metal, but I wouldn't call them heavy metal because they were somewhat melodic. Heavy metal generally isn't very melodic. Heavy metal is what you listen to if you're going deaf and you just like to listen to stuff because you like to put your hand on the speaker and feel the thud thumping from the vibration from the speaker. You don't really care about melody. Back when I was getting into the limited amount of hard rock that I would listen to was mainly Guns N' Roses. You listen to them, it was nice and melodic. Here we go. What's a Guns N' Roses song? Let me give you an example. They had It's a Perfect Crime. Motherfucker, it's a perfect crime. It's a perfect crime. It's perfect. That was a Guns N' Roses song. I think it was called Perfect Crime. I don't think I've even thought about that song in about 30 years. It's not the most memorable of their songs. One of their more memorable songs would be Take Me Down to the Paradise City where the grass is green and the Take Me Down. Now, they did use harmonica in the at least one song, I think. Yes, they did. I remember. There's definitely a couple of Guns N' Roses songs in which they use harmonica. They don't spring to mind at the moment, and I'd have to learn them before I could perform them for you. I know there's definitely some harmonica in there. What else? That's melodic for you. So you get to Guns N' Roses and you still have a bit of melody in there. Anything past that, no. I suppose Metallica had one or two melodic songs in them. What's that one? Nothing Else Matters, that's what they said. They said something, something and something, something. Never something and something, something. Something, something and something, something. And nothing else matters. I like that song, as it happens. I like one or two songs by Metallica. I do happen to like watching documentaries about Metallica. They have this fella. He went off for a year to either dry out or go to rehab or get off whatever he was doing that he felt was harming him. When he got back, he was in the studio with them, but he was only allowed to be there with them for 3 or 4 hours a day. And there's a whole documentary about that era. The drummer there was saying things like, is it supposed to be a fucking rock band? And this fella's in here part-time and then having to go off like some part-time school class or something and the bell rings. He doesn't say those exact words. But he expresses how pissed off he is at the situation. There's a fucking rock band and we have this fella. It's like he's out on day release. He's allowed to come in here and sing for, it was either 3 hours a day or 4 hours a day. So he'd come in the afternoon and he'd do some work with them in the studio. And then you'd be looking at the clock and go, oh, it's time for me to go. The bell is rung now. It's time to line up at the door and our parents will come and collect us and let us out. If you're going to school for 4 hours a day or 3 hours, I can't remember. It was either 3 hours a day or 4 hours a day he was allowed to work. Now, I know that's not exactly the same as going to school. Although in many schools, you do go in and spend some time performing music. Especially in the early days of primary school. In fact, in the early days of primary school, 4 hours was about as much as you spent there. So you go in around 9:30. The youngest kids would usually finish around 2. The bell would ring and they'd be lined up at the door. The parents would be outside and say, oh, I must keep an eye on the door here and watch out for my child for when they come out. I was going to look mad if my child comes out and I don't notice them or I don't recognise them. So I'm going to have to concentrate. If you're a new parent, this is your first kid that you've sent to school, you're probably very self-conscious. When you go down to the school, the teacher doesn't know you because it's your first kid that you've sent to that school. You're very self-conscious. Your eyes fixed on the front door or the front gate or wherever they emerge from. And you watch these kids coming out, and they do all look the same. They make them wear uniforms. So it's like standing outside a military academy. Everyone's dressed exactly the same. They've all got exactly the same haircut, got exactly the same tie and shirt and trousers on. Probably the exact same school bags as well, but that's more to do with fashion. The school doesn't usually prescribe a style of school bag to wear, but they wear the same because kids align themselves to whatever the fashion is. If the fashion is to wear a canvas bag with the name of a particular band stenciled on it, then they all do that. So that doesn't help at all. You ever think the kids would want to be individuals so they'd at least dress their school bag differently? Well, no, they're all exactly the same. When I was going to school, half of the class had these red school bags, like a small plastic hold all, had a zip across the top, it had a shoulder strap, and it was red, and it had the name of one of two or three main English football clubs. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, he's not from England. And that's correct. I'm not from England. This was in Ireland. Invariably, they'd be red, and they'd have Arsenal or Manchester or something, or Liverpool or something on them. They put that on their bags and they say, I identify as a supporter of this particular English football team. I was a weirdo. I didn't follow football at all. I barely knew what football was. I knew it was considered to be a sport of some kind. I knew it involved going into a changing room, changing out of your comfortable, smart, nice, soft cotton trouser wear. The most comfortable part of the school uniform was the trousers. They were nice until you pissed in them. Then they were very hard to conceal anything when that happened. Oh no, you had a nice pair of trousers. You're expected to take that off and then put on a pair of shorts or tracksuit bottoms. When I was in primary school, we played hurling. So you dressed the same way as you do for football, but he'd also wear a helmet because your head was considered valuable in those days. Especially in school, they'd recognise that you're in your school, you were primarily there for academic purposes, so it was important to protect your head so that you could use it, because otherwise all the other teachers would get pissed off. Your sports physical education lesson is usually one class a week out of 40 or 45 class periods into which the week is divided. Sometimes there's a double. One to two of those 45 or so classes during a standard school week. So if you're getting your head damaged during that period, so your head doesn't work properly anymore, the other 43 classes are going to be affected. Your performance in the other 43 classes, all of which were academic and involved your brain, would all be affected because of one or two classes. And that's disproportionate. So they put. They put value on protecting your head. So you wore a helmet. You put a helmet on your head. You cover your entire head except for your face. Because you needed your face exposed. You needed to be able to see out through your face. We didn't have that grill over the front of our face like you Americans have with your American football. You overdo it. You do. You put a grill in front of your face. Like it's a car engine or something. You put a grill in front of it. No, I wouldn't want that. It looked like a gate of a trellis or a castle or something. Not that it really matters what you look like, but no, it's a bit much. You can't enjoy the fresh air and the running around in the sports if you're going to be locked into a helmet there that feels like you're in a prison. You might as well be in a cage on the back of a truck. It's part of a circus. You're in the cage that they use to transport the circus animals. They put them on display. They have a cage on it. So when they were traveling from town to town, this traveling circus, they could display the animals in a cage on the back of a truck. So when they're stuck in some traffic jam down the main street of your town, at least it's doubling as a billboard for the circus. People look up and say, oh, isn't that great? Look at those animals in that portable cage there on the back of the lorry. They must be from that circus. Are they going to set up here? Or are they on their way out of town? You think they've left. You're not going to see them again for 2 or 3 years. But no, you go out for a drive in the car one day to the next town and you see the exact same circuses there. They just set up again further down the road, a few miles down. I suppose that's reasonable. You don't go jumping straight from one end of the country to the other in one jump. No, you follow a circuit, you take reasonably short hops, but still, takes a bit away from the hype. People are going, oh, you have to see the circus while it's in town. No, I don't have to see the circus while it's in town. I can see it when it's in the next town a week from now and it turns up somewhere else. And quite easily see it then. In fact, that might even be a better place to see it. They might have better venues or better facilities, or it might be just a more interesting town. I know it's the same tent. There might be better parking or something. The tent remains the same. I know that. I think I was at a circus once in my life. You can't help noticing when you look down through the seats. You can see through the gaps, the down below the seats. You're not really in a theatre at all. That's what freaked me out as a kid going to a circus. You look down behind these seats and there's nothing. You realise this isn't a building at all. It's barely even a floor. You're on a sloped thing that's basically the back of a lorry. Down below is just grass. You're just on this thing that's been stuck in a field somewhere. Everywhere you go, lift up the tent flap and you look under it, all you see is the outdoors. It's not a real building at all. And then they have these things hanging from ropes from the roof of this so-called building, and they have trapeze artists swinging from them like monkeys. Very like that thing. I mentioned this previously, this French lunatic who got up on a tight rope once and walked from one of the sadly destroyed twin towers to the other in the World Trade Center in New York. Is fucking lunatic, and was promptly arrested when they eventually, well, not promptly, they had to wait until he came in. The cops came up, better arrest this fella before he, I don't know, before he succeeds in, frankly, this amazing feat. The cops stood there aghast watching this French fella. He was already on the rope, he was halfway across. He went all the way across from one twin tower roof to the other twin tower roof. And then presumably he had to look around and said, oh, this seems to be the same place. These towers are identical. I'm going to go back the way I came. There's nothing to be gained from going down through the other tower. I'm going to go back the way I came. It's not like a Sunday drive where you plan a circuit or a route so you don't have to come back the same way you came so you get to see something different. He said, no, not going to see anything different if I dismount from the rope here on the second tower and go down through that. I'm just going to go back the way I came. So then he came back and the cops waited for him and arrested and or congratulated him. I think they did a bit of both. Said, what in the name of Christ is wrong with you? Also, well done. That was fucking amazing. And then there's people down on the street. According to the movie and the documentary anyway, there were people down on the street about 3 miles below on the city streets looking up going, is that some fella walking through the air between the twin towers? I wonder, is he lost? Maybe he's lost. It'd be quite easy to get lost up there, I suppose. It's not like walking around. If you walk between the twin towers on the ground, it's hard to get lost there because you just follow the footpaths. The city streets have a certain layout. You can follow the streets and the footpaths. But if you're just walking through the air on a rope, I suppose you follow the rope shows you where to go. If there's bad visibility and you can't see the rope, you can't get lost because you're following the rope. But what can happen is that you can't see where the rope is leading, so you don't know which way you're facing or where you're going. You just know, if I stay on this rope, I'll get to the other tower, but I can't see a fucking thing. Maybe that's enjoyable, I don't know. Our fella apparently is having the time of his life. Said, I'm French. This is a fucking beautiful building. I'm going to get up on this rope and walk across it. And that'll be my life done then. I'm happy once I've done that. They didn't say whether he went on to do anything more spectacular after that. Did he walk from the moon to Mars or something? I don't know.
Have a comment, question, or topic request? Email Neil anytime. studio@intoyourhead.ie.
I've just been for a piss. I've just been over to the ensuite while I was uploading the previous segment, and I had a good, long, healthy piss into the toilet. It was great. It's absolutely great. I just stood there, let her go, and then when it was finished, I didn't rush off. I just stood there for another minute. I just stood there looking out the window. Couldn't see much out the window because it's one of those fogged up bathroom windows. It's intentionally fogged up. It's a bit like a stained glass window, except it doesn't have an interesting picture drawn on it. It's just kind of artificially frosted. It's got a pattern that's designed to be non-transparent, so you can't see anything into it. Unfortunately, I also can't see anything out of it. I think that's all for the best. Because if you had a bathroom window that you could clearly see out of, but you can't see in, I think I would spend much of my time worrying that people could in fact see in through it. And on an intellectual basis, I'd know that it's a one-way window. Just because I can see clearly out through the window, that doesn't mean they can see in. But I'd be worried about it anyway. I think I'd probably go and put a net curtain on it just in case. And that would defeat the purpose. That would defeat it. You don't want a net curtain anyway. In a bathroom or apparently anywhere else, apparently they're completely out of fashion. Yeah, apparently people don't do net curtains anymore. People say that's an old thing. That's something your grandmother would have if their kitchen was at the front of their house. You put a net curtain. No, those are completely out of fashion. At best, you can have a Venetian blind. Now, a Venetian blind, for the uninitiated, it's a type of blind that's made up of long horizontal strips of wood or firm material. And if you open and close the slots by pulling at the string, the purpose of a Venetian blind, it's kind of like doing a crossword in the newspaper every day. You operate a Venetian blind every morning for about 15 minutes to exercise your brain to ward off the arrival of old age dementia. It's very good for your brain because you spend about half an hour trying to determine whether you've got the horizontal flaps at the exact right angle so that you can see out of it and get enough light into it, but nobody can see in. There's a lot of guessing involved. Unless every time you adjust it, you run outside to look and see, can you see in through the window? And even that's not going to work, because then if you can't see in through the window right outside, you're going to be worried. Can people see it from out on the street or from different distances or angles? You're never going to be sure. So it's good for their brain to operate a Venetian blind at least once a day. So it's as good for you, I would argue, as doing at least the simplex crossword in the Irish Times, if not the main Irish Times cryptic crossword. I would say the Venetian blind isn't quite as challenging as the cryptic crossword, but it's definitely more challenging than the regular crossword that just has normal clues for normal people. So it's probably good, I suppose, to have that. But no, those are out of fashion. If a young person like me got net curtains put in my house, I would be considered a weirdo. Out of touch with the young people. Young people aren't doing that anymore. The main reason young people aren't doing that anymore is because they can't afford anywhere to live. But also, if they could, they wouldn't be putting net curtains on their windows, apparently. Once upon a time, there was a dog. 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 Basically, a dog. And this dog, he was walking along the street one day, minding his own business, following the double yellow line that borders the main thoroughfare, the side of this road. The dog doesn't realise they're there to signify that you're not allowed to park there. That doesn't affect the dog. He's not a vehicle. He's not in control of a vehicle. If he were in control of a vehicle, somebody would be in trouble. Not necessarily the dog, maybe the dog's owner would be in trouble, because you can't have a dog in control of a vehicle in the modern world. That's not viable in a safe world where people are reasonably safe and we have public thoroughfares. No. If you're a human motorist going out onto this road in good faith and you've paid your motor tax and you're obeying the rules of the road as best you can and you've paid your insurance and you've obeyed all the laws and you're driving out in good faith, you're entitled to expect that there aren't out-of-control dogs going around driving vehicles on this road. You're entitled to expect that much from society, that you're not sharing the road with someone's dog who's being allowed to drive. So no, the dog wasn't driving. In fact, the dog wasn't even in a vehicle. The dog was just following the yellow line. The yellow line is good for a dog. Well, for the more intelligent dogs, or the dogs who strive to be more intelligent. There are dogs who want to be more intelligent than they are. They have ambition. They know they have limitations. They know, I'm a dog, there's only so much I can do, but they aspire to being more. And the double yellow line for a reasonably self-aware dog like that might be helpful, because the dog can think, oh, I can use these lines as my guide. I can walk in a reasonably straight line along here. Every 3 steps when I stop for a miniature piss, I can aim between the 2 lines and that'll keep me somewhat on track. Oh no, these 2 lines are very helpful. In the same way that those 2 lines are helpful to human society in that they keep us on track in terms of obeying the parking laws and keeping the lane free, an intelligent dog may make good use of those lines. I know that's not what the lines were intended for, but the dog has found some use for that. And I could respect a dog who would do that. That's a dog who's trying to make something of himself. He aspires to being somewhat of a citizen of this world, of the modern world. I know dogs are already citizens of the world. They were around long before human infrastructure was built. But no, he's trying to fit in. I think that's a good thing. If your dog is doing that, I think that's admirable. You're a good dog owner if your dog does something like that. You're a reasonably good dog owner, even though the dog shouldn't be out on its own unsupervised and should be on a leash in some park somewhere, and you should be stopping it every 3 steps and holding a plastic bag under its genitals for it to urinate into, and not letting it pee every 3 steps on the ground. But apart from that, no, you're a step above the average dog owner if your dog is at that point where he's using the double yellow lines in a way that's not intended. That's a dog who wants to advance himself. He's doing as much as he can. So, credit where it's due. I give that dog and its owner some credit. So well done. Well done to all involved there. That's all I wanted to say. If you're listening to this from underneath a table, perhaps you're a puppeteer for the Muppets. Perhaps you're performing Miss Piggy's hindquarters, or perhaps you're involved in a magic trick where you're supposedly being sawn in half by a magician. You're the magician's assistant and you've scrunched yourself up into this box, and you're supposed to stick your legs out of the box, and your twin is in the other side of the box that's separated now. Your twin is going to stick their head out of the other side of that box, and you're going to create the impression that the magician has sawn their assistant in half. In other words, you're involved in a fraud. You're involved in a fraud. That's fraudulent. You should be absolutely ashamed of yourself, and so should your opposite number. Legs or no legs, head or no head, you're both involved in a fraud. You're tricking people into thinking that you've been chopped in half by, well, they probably use a saw, does he? You know what? When magicians do the cutting someone in half thing, it's usually a saw that's involved. They don't get out an axe and start chopping and hacking away. Because often they think, oh, this is great. I'm going to be on prime time television doing this. Perhaps on British television, on one of those Royal Variety performances. They have these things once a year on British television. They have this Royal Variety performance. They have the king or the queen in a box up above the audience. They have magicians and singers and things. It's probably the highlight of a magician's year, because there isn't that much magicianship on the television these days. So this fella who's a magician, who's chopping people in half, he's doing it with a view to performing it on television someday to a family audience. So he's probably thinking, no, I can't just violently hack my assistant in half with an axe. I'll do it with a saw, so it's nice and neat. So I saw through a box containing my assistant, and there isn't going to be blood everywhere. I know either way, if there was blood, there would be fake, because it's an illusion. But even still, you don't do a thing where you chop away at it with an axe, because that would be a bit too violent. People wouldn't be able to let their children watch that on the television. And these are magicians. They're obsessed with going on the television, with trying to get onto the television. So no, they don't do it with an axe. They do it with a saw, because that's considered neater and tidier and less violent. It's It's more like doing carpentry, and people are okay with that. People associate carpentry with godliness, because Jesus Christ was a carpenter for the first 30 years of his life. His father was a carpenter, as far as I know, for his entire life. His father, Joseph. Now, was that the same Joseph who's depicted in James and the Technicolor Dreamcoat? I don't think so. I'd rather Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. I always call it James by mistake because I get confused with Roald Dahl's James and the Giant Peach, which is a whole different kettle of fish. No, it's Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. It's a musical. And that's supposed to have something to do with biblical times. Because I remember when we were reading about Joseph and his son Jesus in school, there wasn't anything about a Technicolor Dreamcoat. There's at least two different Josephs then. And one of them went on to be the subject of an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. Was there anything about a dream coat in the Bible? You'd be surprised at what turns up in the Bible lately. Because there's a fella called Jonah who was stuck inside a whale. And that had something to do with the Bible. If they have stuff like that in it, surely they can have a fella with a magical dream coat who sings songs surrounded by children. No law against it. They have prostitutes in the Bible. They have tax collectors in the Bible. They have leprosy in the Bible. Leprosy is quite prominent in the Bible. They have a fellow who has leprosy. I can't remember the exact details. Jesus goes and shakes his hand or something and everyone's shocked because you don't touch a leper. You don't touch a leper because apparently you get something off them. I cannot remember. Did he offer to cure the leper or did he just offer to shake his hand and say, oh, look, everyone, I'm shaking the leper's hands and look, my head isn't falling off. Isn't that great? He goes home and then you go, oh Christ, in all the excitement and unusually positive attention, I forgot to get him to cure me. Imagine how sick you'd feel after that. As we speak, it's in the news at the moment, a heavy company that has been letting people work from home for the past couple of years is now calling them back in and saying, no, get out of that house, get back into their office. They're saying COVID is over, get your arse up off that sofa and get your arse up off that home office chair and get your arse into this office that we have in the city centre somewhere. That's what apparently every corporation in the world is doing now. They're saying get onto that bus or that train or that car and then transport yourself up to this place in the city. And then get out your clock-in card and slide it through this thing at the door. These offices, they have a card that you use to gain security access to the building or also to register the fact that you've arrived. You have this card. It's a symbol to everyone that you've arrived. You put it through, you slide it through this card reader. Registers it with your personnel department. And say, oh, he's arrived. He's made it. Isn't that great? And then you go up the stairs or you go up in an elevator or a lift to whatever floor. I used to do this. I worked in a big office building. You go in. They had quite an old-fashioned system, so you couldn't just slide your card through. You put your card in. It'd be like putting your card into a little toaster. You'd put it in and then you'd take it out. You'd have to take it out at the exact right speed or it wouldn't register. There was a knack to it. Maybe that was intentional, so people who didn't genuinely work there couldn't trick their way in just by stealing a card and using it. No, it would only work for people who knew exactly what speed to put the card in and take it out. If you take it out too fast, it didn't register. If you took it out too slowly, it didn't register. You had to do it exactly right, and you can only get it exactly right by doing it 5 days a week for at least a year. A year is usually how long it takes to be confirmed as a permanent employee. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. They go into these offices now. Not allowed to work from home anymore. To go into this office, you sit down at this desk. And there's no such thing as rooms anymore, except for the big wigs. Do they still call them big wigs? I don't know. They used to call them big wigs, these big high-up people in offices. They'd be in some corner office or they'd be up on some fancy floor where all the senior people are. And then everyone else would be in this open layout thing. They might have some kind of wooden partitions between the desks. But the partitions have been getting smaller and smaller decade by decade. And if you look at something like that situation comedy, The Office, You see an example of this. You see, they have a little low wall for sticking notices to. It's not really a partition anymore. You have a desk and you have another desk and they're facing each other and you have a little bit of partition between them and you stick little post-it notes to that. And that's the only privacy you have. And rightly so. It's not your house. You shouldn't have privacy in an office. You're all in it together. If you're hiding something from the other people in that office, then it's something that he shouldn't be doing in the office. He should be doing it at home. You've no right to any privacy in that office. So forget all that. If the idea is that you want some separateness from the other desk because it helps you concentrate, then wear those blinkers that they put on horses. Horses wear these things. They're like shades. They put either side of their face so they're not distracted from anything in their peripheral vision. I have that built in. I have very poor peripheral vision, almost tunnel vision. I have large black spots in my peripheral vision. So I'm not easily distracted by stuff coming out from the sides. When I do finally notice something popping out from nowhere, it gives me a fright. So I'd be walking along some corridor. Someone's been walking beside me all along. I wouldn't have noticed them, but then they turn left and cut in front of me and I go, "Oh Christ, where did you come out of?" I've learned not to say that to them. I just think, "Where in the name of Christ did that fella come out of?" And they do that to me when I'm crossing the road at a pedestrian crossing. I'm crossing the road. I've taken care to wait for the signal. I press the button. The man goes green and the thing starts beeping. It's as safe as it's ever going to be. I'll cross now. So then I cross now, and half the time while I'm crossing the road, some fucking moron, some other pedestrian, decides to take a shortcut and cut across in front of me. I find that very confusing. So if that was happening in an office, or if that was happening to me and I was a horse, I would find that problematic. Thankfully, I don't work either in an office or as a horse anymore. So that's good, I suppose. I suppose it's good that I'm useless now, so that's good. Anyway, where was it? Oh, yes. A corporation should have half of its staff working in a pared-down office in the city centre and half of its staff working around the suburbs or around the country in various little apartment buildings. And the people who are working in the apartments, they'd live in the city centre office. So at the beginning of each day, they'd leave their city centre dwelling, which would be in an office building in the city centre, and they'd travel out into the suburbs to an apartment where they'd spend their day working. And then the people who were working in the office in the city centre, they would live in those apartments, and in the morning they'd be travelling into the city centre. So half of the commuting traffic would be going inbound and half of it outbound, and we'd have a much better balance of traffic and public transport. You wouldn't have all these buses going into the city centre and coming back empty every morning. No, that would be the way to do it. Well, of course they won't do that, because they can't stand the idea of, I don't know what they can't stand the idea of. Maybe they just think this is the way work is. You work in an office in the city centre and then you fuck off home when we let you and you clock out. You clock out. You over there, clock. See, you clock out. That's what you do, clock out. And then continue working. Do they allow you to wait until you're finished working before you clock out nowadays? Or they probably don't. They probably say, "Oh, you officially finish at 5. Clock out at 5 and then finish your work that you should have completed by 5 and then you may leave." I might be somewhat out of touch with how the workplace works. I don't know. Suffice to say, nothing. Do you work in an office? You probably do. Probably the office janitor or the office tea lady or the office manager or the office junior or the general office staff who do office-y stuff at a desk. Office-y stuff at a desk usually involves sitting down at a desk with a telephone and a computer of some kind, and perhaps a biro or writing implement. Do you still use writing implements? You probably do. When you take a phone call, if you're not in a call centre, you answer the phone. You're not doing something where you read a script and you type stuff onto a screen. I presume you're still allowed to write stuff with a writing implement. I used to write stuff with a writing implement. In those days, I used to answer the phone and say, "Hello, who's this?" And they'd say who they are, and straight away, my left hand would be out. I'd reach for my biro, my ballpoint writing implement, and I'd start writing on a scrap of paper just in case this was something I needed to remember. Because they'll only say this once. People will ring up the office, especially if they're a customer or a client. They'll say, "Listen very carefully. I'm only going to say this once." And I say, "Do you mind if I write this down?" And they say, "That's a weird thing to ask. Why would I mind?" And I'd say, "That was going to be my next question if you said yes." And then I'd make a note. I'd say, "Doesn't mind me writing this down." And then I'd say, "How may I help you, sir or madam?" And they'd say, "What time are you open until?" And then I'd say, "Well, I usually close my mouth after I've had my last meal for the evening. But I might have a snack later, and then I might have a drink of water, which involves partially opening my mouth. I don't usually use a straw. I do open my mouth when I'm drinking water or sipper. If I'm drinking out of a sippy bottle, I barely open it at all. Certainly not as far as I would open it for the purposes of eating or for the purposes of speaking to you, sir or madam." So yes, I suppose I close my mouth around maybe 6:30 after I finished my evening meal. It's pretty much closed up for the night. And it's not a strict rule. And they'd say, "That's great. And what time does your business close at?" And I'd say, "Oh, hopefully it'll never close. It's my livelihood. I don't want it to close. I want it to stay open forever. Why, have you heard something different?" And then they'd say, "Oh, I see what's going on here. You're making a podcast in the middle of July. And your heart isn't really in it. It's not really going particularly well. You've done some big long segment of something about windows and crosswords, and now you're on to something about offices. It's so long since you've worked in an office, you can barely remember how they work. But you're also adding detail that you know full well is bullshit, even though you haven't worked for an office in some time. I think you know full well that it doesn't involve you telling people what time you close your mouth at. It doesn't. It really doesn't. And you know that. You know that." And of course, I'd say to that, I'd say, "You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And just nothing seems to be going anywhere for me today. I don't know. We're 15 minutes into this segment, and I very much doubt any of it is usable. I very much doubt any of this is usable at all." And of course, they'll say to that, they'll say, "Well then, how about we call it quits?" And of course I say to that, "Absolutely, I'll call it quits." "Well wait, if I call it quits, you mean end my podcast?" And I say, "No, of course not. That'll be not. Don't be a giver upper. No, I don't mean call it quits in that way. Don't give up." As the song goes, there's a song you may have heard by your one. Who's your one? The English one who was a star around 14 years of age in the 1970s. She did that song with the fella out of Genesis who used to wear the masks. Something along the lines of, "Don't give up. Something, 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 something. Don't give up. Something, something, something. In this old world we grew up strong. Something, 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 something." Of course I'd say to that, "I refer to that song in another segment on this unusable podcast. That's fascinating. It's almost as if you're coming from the same brain as me, like we have a shared brain." And of course, the caller will say to that, they'll say, "Yes, I'm a voice in your head. I'm a voice in your head that you're imagining. This is all imagined. I'm about as real as that cat who appears in your Two Cats Walk Into a Bar stories." So which I'd say, of course, "Excuse me, that cat is very real to me. It may be a fictional cat, but it's a creation of mine that's been with me for nigh on 20 years now. I've been dealing with that fictional cat. In fact, since before it was podcasting, I was dealing with that fictional cat in a bar. I'll have you know I was doing Two Cats Walk Into a Bar stories in writing in 2004. What's it now? That's 21 years. That cat who walks into the bar every day, he's been doing that for 21 years. Now, presumably he didn't start going into bars until he was at least 2. So he's at least 23 years old now, that cat. So I'd say he has another 10 years of life in him, or 7 years of good life. So he will have another while. And then even after that, he can still carry on doing stories about him. When Hardy, out of Laurel and Hardy, died, Stan Laurel continued writing scripts for Laurel and Hardy. I'm not sure what he did with them, but he still kept writing them. So just because the fictional cat who walks into the bar dies, that doesn't mean I have to stop doing Two Cats Walk Into a Bar stories. I can just keep doing that forever, which I find quite reassuring. There's something reassuring about that, isn't there? And of course, the caller will say to this, I think I'm superfluous to this segment now. I've served my purpose. I've served my purpose like a bloody circus. Isn't that song too? We served our purpose like a bloody circus. We were so something. We something something. Oh, Was It All Worth It by Queen. Not a particularly well-known song. It was a B-side. But Was It All Worth It by Queen. It's a very uplifting song because he goes on through the whole thing going, Was it all worth it? Living, breathing, rock and roll and staying up all night. He goes on for that the whole song. Then at the end he goes, yes, it was worth it. It was a worthwhile experience. Oh. And then he dies. And that was quite an uplifting song nonetheless.